Chapter 8. "He has missed his tide," said Sir Joseph. "I have rarely been more vexed."
"Soames handled the matter like a fool," said Stephen. "If only he had taken it lightly, if only he had started talking about the daily civil lies of not at home, humble obedient servant, and so on, had then moved on to the various face-saving formulae of treaties and the like, treating them as the silly, unimportant trifles they are, and had then asked Aubrey to put his name to the solicitation already and made out, he might well have signed with a thankful heart, a heart overflowing with happiness."
"It is the damnedest thing," said Sir Joseph, following his own line of thought. "Even with all the susceptibilities that had to be taken into account, Quinborough and his allies, to name only them, for the moment the balance was just leaning in Aubrey's favour, just leaning far enough for the decisive action. Could not you persuade him to tell Soames that on mature consideration, etc.? After all, like every other sailor, he has been brought up to think nothing of cheerful corruption. Vast quantities of stores disappear. Dead men and non-existent servants continue to draw their wages. And to my certain knowledge, he has been guilty of at least 3 false masters, entering his friends' sons on the ship's books in order to gain them sea time, when in fact they are at school on dry land. Why, in a ghostly form, his own half-brother was aboard last time you were in the Pacific."
"Cheerful corruption, yes. And if that had been the approach, he might possibly have worn it, as sailors say. But now that it is a high moral issue, with all cheerfulness flown out of the window, I could not possibly shift him, nor should I attempt it."
"Well, as I say, it is the damnedest thing. To be so near success, and then to—"
After a pause, Stephen said hesitantly,
"I suppose there is no possibility of an act of grace without any formal solicitation?"
"No. At the moment Aubrey has a good many allies, and therefore a great deal of interest, but he has not enough for that. Considerably more would be needed."
"This makes no difference?"
Stephen pointed to the carefully written pages in which Pratt reported his discovery of General Aubrey, dead in a ditch near the alehouse in which he had been living under the name of Captain Woolcombe. Blaine shook his head.
"No,"
he said.
"As far as the Ministry is concerned, the General and his Radical friends were quite exploded when they failed to answer their bail. They ceased to exist politically. Even the most disreputable opposition newspapers could have nothing to do with them, and the General might just as well have died then as now. And it makes no difference, from our point of view either, since Pratt and his colleagues have been through and through the General's papers, without finding the least hint of any contact with Ray and Ledwood."
"Of course not. There can have been no possible connection."
"On the other hand," observed Blaine, "it might be said that this death does do Aubrey's cause some little good, in that the involuntary radical link is done away with. But the good is nothing remotely like enough, alas and alas. What do you propose to do now, Maturin?"
"I shall send Pratt the necessary instructions to deal with the body and post down to Aubrey tomorrow. Then, since the surprise is yet to be prepared and provided with a vast quantity of stores required for the South American voyage, I believe I shall go to Sweden and wait for him there. I shall take the packet from Leith."
"You do not suppose that this death will change Aubrey's plans?"
"It would surprise me if he were much affected. The General was not a man to inspire any great liking or esteem."
"No, but there is a not inconsiderable estate, I am told."
"Little do I know of it, except that it is sadly encumbered. But even if it were half the county, I do not believe it would keep Jack Aubrey from the sea. He has engaged for this voyage, and in any case it is said that the Americans have sent one or perhaps 2 frigates of our own class round the Horn."
The Aubreys had been buried at Woolhampton for many generations, and the church was filled with people. Jack was surprised and touched to find that such numbers had come to honour the funeral, since for a great while now Woolcombe House had seen none of the solid, long-established families who had dined there so regularly in former times, when Jack's mother was alive. There were some missing faces, of course, but many, many fewer than Jack had expected. Then again the congregation was made up not only of old friends and connections of the Aubreys, but also of tenants, villagers, and men and women from the outlying cottages, who seemed to have forgotten ill-treatment, rack rent, and the oppressive enclosure of Woolhampton Common. Another thing that particularly moved him was the way women from the village, many of whom had been his mother's and even his grandmother's servants, had hurried up to Woolcombe to make the house fit to receive so many guests. It had been allowed to run down sadly, even before the long period when the General was flitting about in the North Country, afraid of arrest. But now the drive was as trim as ever it had been, and the public rooms at least were scrubbed, swept, and beeswaxed, while tables had been set out to feed those who had come from a distance. One table, with all its leaves spread, was in the dining parlour, and another, to be presided over by Harry Charnock of Tarrant Gussage, Jack's nearest cousin, stood on trestles in the library. The General's widow played no part in any of this. As soon as the hearse was known to have reached Shaftesbury, she had taken to her bed, and she had not moved from it since. Various reasons for her behaviour were put forward, but no one ever mentioned extreme grief. Whatever the cause, Jack was heartily glad of the fact. She had been a dairymaid at Woolcombe, a fine, snapping, black-eyed girl, apt to come home late from fairs and dances, and pretty well known to the local young men, including Jack. Although he felt a certain moral indignation when his father married her, it had soon worn off. He did not think her a bad woman at all. For example, he did not believe the present rumour that she was keeping her bed because the family silver was hidden under it, but he had not forgotten their nights in the hayloft either, and this made their meetings awkward, and he had to admit that on those rare occasions when he came down, it could not but wound him to see her sitting where his mother had sat. So Mrs. Aubrey stayed in bed, and Sophie, being most reluctant to obtrude on her sorrow or to appear in the house as its present mistress so soon, had stayed in Hampshire. But the second Mrs. Aubrey's son, Philip, had been brought back from school. He was too young, a very little boy, to have much piety, and at first he had not been sure whether this was meant to be a celebration or not. He soon caught Jack's tone, however, and now in his new black clothes, he walked about with his tall half-brother as they acknowledged their guest's kindness in coming, and echoed his,
"I thank you, sir, for the honour you do us."
He spoke up well, with neither too much confidence nor too much timidity, and Jack was pleased with him. They had not met half a dozen times since Philip was breeched, but Jack felt a certain responsibility for him, and in case he should wish to make the Navy his career rather than the Army, he had had his name entered on the books of various ships for the last few years, while Heneage Dundas, soon to be home from North America, had provisionally agreed to take him to sea as soon as he was old enough. Jack thought it probable that the boy would do him credit. But he had little time to reflect on Philip's future, because as he was trying to induce his guests to sit down, he saw an elderly man, indeed an old man, thin and very tall in spite of his stoop, walk slowly into the dining parlour and peer about the crowded room. This was one of the missing, the understandably missing, faces he had regretted in the church, Mr. Norton, a very considerable landowner on the other side of the Stour. Although his connection with the Aubreys was fairly remote, its existence and the close friendship between the families meant that Jack had been brought up calling him Cousin Edward. It was Cousin Edward who had nominated Jack's father for the pocket borough of Millport, which lay on one of his estates, and which the General had represented in Parliament first as a Tory and then as an extreme Radical, according to what he considered his interest. Echoes of the furious quarrel that resulted from this change, and indeed from the member's general course of conduct, had reached Jack on the other side of the world, distressing him very much. On coming home, he found that the echoes fell far short of the truth, and he had never supposed he should see Mr. Norton at Woolcombe again.
"Cousin Edward!" he cried, hurrying forward. "How very good of you to come!"
"I am so sorry to be late, Jack," said Mr. Norton, shaking his hand, and looking into his face with grave concern. "But my fool of a coachman overturned me the other side of Barton, and it was a great while before I could get along."
"I am afraid you were much shaken, sir," said Jack.
He called out,
"Ladies, pray be seated without ceremony. Gentlemen, I beg you will sit down."
He led Mr. Norton to a chair, poured him a glass of wine, and the meal began at last. A long meal, and tedious, with all the awkwardness inherent in such occasions. But it did have an end in time, and upon the whole it went off very much better than Jack had feared. When he had seen the last of his guests into their carriages, he returned to the small drawing-room, where he found Cousin Edward dozing in his wing chair, one of the few old pieces of furniture that had escaped the modernization of Woolcombe House. He tiptoed out, and in the passage he came upon Philip, who asked, "Should I not say good-bye to Cousin Edward?"
"No, he will be staying the night. His coach was overset the other side of Barton and broke a wheel. Besides, he was much shaken. He is very old."
"Older than my father. Our father was, I dare say, sir."
"Oh, much older. He and my grandfather were contemporaries."
"What are contemporaries?"
"People of the same age. But it usually means people you knew when you were young together, school friends and so on. At least, that is what I mean. Cousin Edward and my grandfather were contemporaries, and they were great friends. They had a pack of hounds together when they were young fellows. They hunted the hare."
"Have you many contemporaries, sir?"
"No, not by land. There was almost no one here of my age whom I knew well, apart from Harry Charnock. I went away to sea so early, hardly much older than you."
"But you do feel at home here, sir, do you not?" asked the boy, with a curious anxiety and even distress. "You do feel that this is a place you cannot be turned out of?"
"Yes,"
said Jack, not only to please him.
"And now I am going to look at the vine house and the walled garden. I used to play fives, left hand against right, on the back of it when I was a boy. Yet now I come to reflect, since we are brothers, you should probably call me Jack, although I am so much older."
Philip said, "Yes," and blushed, but spoke no more until they came to the vine house, disused now as it had been in Jack's day, where he showed him a frog said to be tame in the stone bath that perpetually overflowed, still with the same musical drip. The walled kitchen garden was even more unchanged, if possible. The same exact rows of vegetables, bean poles, gooseberry bushes, currants, the same cucumber and melon frames, so vulnerable to a flying ball, and the same smelly box hedges, while on the red brick walls themselves apricots and peaches were changing colour. Indeed, the whole back of the house, stable-yard, laundry, coach-house, all the unimproved part was infinitely familiar, reaching back to the first things Jack had ever known, as familiar as cock-crow, so that at moments he might have been far younger than the little boy running about in his incongruous black suit. By the time they went in, bats were mixing with the swallows that skimmed over the horse-pond, and Mr. Norton had already gone to bed. Jack did not see him again until well on in the next morning. The Dorchester attorney had just taken his leave, carrying off his bag of legal papers, when Cousin Edward appeared.
"Good morning to you, Jack," he said. "You have had a long session of it, I fear. I saw Withers arrive as I was shaving. I hope that does not mean disputes or wrangling."
"No, sir, it all ended happy," said Jack, "though there were many details to be sorted out."
Most of the delay had in fact been caused by his stepmother's extreme unwillingness to reveal the fact that she could not sign her name, but that was not a point Jack chose to raise. He said,
"Shall we have a pot of coffee in the morning-room?"
"I can no longer find my way about this house," said Mr. Norton as they walked in. "Apart from my bedroom and the library, everything has been changed since I was here last. Even the staircase."
"Yes, but I intend to put at least the hall back as it was," said Jack, "and my mother's rooms. I found nearly all the old panelling heaped up in the barn behind the rickyard."
"Do you mean to live here?"
"I don't know. That depends on Sophie. Our place in Hampshire is mighty inconvenient, but she has known it all her married life, and she has many friends there. But in any case, I should like Woolcombe to look more or less as it did when I was a boy. My stepmother does not wish to stay here. It is much too big for her, and she would be lonely. She thinks of settling in Bath, where she has relatives."
"Well, I am glad you're going to keep at least one foot in the country," said Cousin Edward with a significant look. And when the coffee came, he said, "Jack, I'm happy to have you alone like this."
There was a pause, and when he went on, his tone was quite different, as though he were reciting words he had composed earlier with some care, perhaps changing them from time to time. It was also evident that he was nervous.
"I dare say you was surprised to see me yesterday," he said. "I know Caroline was, and Harry Charnock, as well as some others, and ordinarily speaking I should not have come."
Another pause.
"I do not mean to blackguard your father, Jack, though you know very well how he treated me."
Jack inclined his head in a gesture that might have meant anything.
"But my reason for coming was partly to do what was right by the family. After all, your grandfather and I were the closest of friends, and I loved your mother dearly. Yet even more to mark my sense of what was due to you for your splendid feat at St. Martin's, and even more for the damnable injustice you met with in London."
The door opened, and Philip burst in. On seeing Cousin Edward, he stopped, then came forward with a hesitant step.
"Good morning, sir," he said, reddening. And then, "Brother Jack, the chaise has come for me. I have said goodbye to Mama."
"I will come and see you off," said Jack. And in the hall he said, "Here's a guinea for thee."
"Oh, thank you very much, sir. But would it be very rude were I to say I had rather have something of yours? A pencil end, or an old handkerchief, or a piece of paper with your name wrote on it, to show the fellows at school?"
Jack felt in his waistcoat pocket.
"I tell you what," he said, "you can show them this. It is the pistol ball Dr. Maturin took out of my back at St. Martin's."
He lifted the boy into the post-chaise and said,
"Next holidays, if your mamma can spare you, you must come to Hampshire and meet your nephew and nieces. Some of them are older than you. Ha, ha, ha!"
They waved until the chaise turned the corner, and then Jack walked back into the morning room. The embarrassment had dissipated, and Cousin Edward asked quite easily,
"Shall you be staying some time? I hope so, if only for the sake of your wounds."
"Oh, as for them, they were troublesome for a while, but I heal as quick as a young dog, and now the stitches are out, I scarcely think of them. No, as soon as I have made my round of thanks in the village and at the cottages, I'm away. Surprise is fitting foreign, and there are 1,000 things to attend to as well as the repairs. My surgeon is quite satisfied so long as I travel by chaise, not on horseback."
"Could you not spend an afternoon at Millport to meet the electors? There are not many of them, and those few are all my tenants, so it is no more than a formality. But there is a certain decency to be kept up. The writ will be issued very soon."
Then, seeing Jack's look of astonishment, he went on,
"I mean to offer you the seat."
"Do you, by God?"
cried Jack. And realizing the extent, the importance, the consequence of what his cousin had just said, he went on,
"I think that amazingly handsome in you, sir. I take it more kindly than I can say."
He shook Mr. Norton's thin old hand and sat staring for a while. Possibilities that he hardly dared name flashed and glowed in his mind like a fleet in action. Cousin Edward said,
"I thought it might strengthen your hand in any dealings with government. There is not much merit in being a Member of Parliament, unless perhaps you represent your county, but at least a member with merit of his own is in a position to have it recognized. He can bite as well as bark."
"Exactly so. He carries guns. The other day there was a man connected with the ministry who came to see me unofficially and said that if I crawled flat on my face and begged for a free pardon, it might perhaps be granted. And he either said or implied, I forget which, that if it were granted I might be put back on the list, reinstated. But I told him that asking forgiveness for a crime necessarily meant that the crime had been committed, and as far as I was concerned, no crime had been committed. In effect, I said, dirty dogs ate hungry puddings. That is to say, hungry dogs ate dirty puddings. But in this case, either I was not hungry enough or the pudding was too dirty, and I begged to be excused. So we left it. And I thought I had destroyed my chances forever. But had I been a member, I do not think he would ever have broached the matter like that. Nor, if he had done so, would he have left it there."
"I am certain he would not, particularly if you were a steady, middle-of-the-road, church-and-state kind of member, with no rant of any kind, as I am sure you will be. Not that I make any conditions, Jack. You shall vote as you please, so long as you do not vote to do away with the crown."
"God forbid, sir, God forbid!"
"Yet even as things stood, that was scarcely the way to speak to a man of your reputation."
"I do not think he meant it ill, but he is one of those people in Whitehall, and I have always noticed that they really do believe they belong to a much higher order, as though they had been born on the flag officer's list."
The butler came in, and addressing Mr. Norton, he said, "Sir, Andrew desires me to say, with his duty, that the wheel is repaired. He has the coach in the yard at this moment, and do you please to have it round now, or shall he put the horses up?"
"Let him bring it round now," said Mr. Norton,
and as soon as the door was closed,
"Come, Jack, indulge me in a day's canvassing, will you? The stag at Millport will give us quite a decent dinner, and then we can have a bowl of punch with the burgesses afterwards. It is no more than a form, of course, but they will take it kindly. No doubt they will prate about the political situation rather more than is agreeable, but it is right to pay them this attention, and you can still be home on Wednesday. Or is it too great a sacrifice? Country politics can be a sad bore, I know."
"Sacrifice, Cousin Edward?" cried Jack, springing up. "You could ask a very, very great deal more than that, upon my word and honour. I should give my right arm to be back on the Navy list, or even halfway there."
In Dr. Maturin's already comfortable, lived-in, book-lined room at the Grapes, he and Padine contemplated their baggage with satisfaction. One item was a trifling affair, as tight as a leaden hall sausage, holding what was needed for Stephen's journey to Edinburgh. Stephen's alone, for Padine was to sail north in the Surprise. But their real triumph was the doctor's sea trunk. Padine had profited much from his friendship with Bondon, a prodigy with cordage, and the trunk now stood there in the middle of the floor, fastened with an intricacy of diagonal lines, a sort of network that would have filled any seaman with admiration. The lanyards at each end were finished with a handsome Matthew Walker, and the whole was topped with a double-crowned walnut.
"You have never forgotten my draught, Padine, I am sure," said Stephen.
He did not choose to be more specific, but by draught he meant his nightly comfort of laudanum, as Padine knew very well, it having, by this stage, become so much his own that he would as soon have forgotten his shirt. Though, indeed, Padine's steady dilution with brandy, even greater now, because of their temporary separation, had reduced the taking to little more than an act of faith.
"I have not, gentlemen," he replied. "Is it not under the lid itself, and padded like a relic at that?"
A heavy step on the stairs, and Mrs. Broad, pushing the door open with a crooked elbow, came in with two piles of fresh laundry between her outstretched arms and her chin.
"There now," she cried, "all your frilled shirts got up prime, with the finest goffering iron you ever seen. Mrs. Maturin always liked them got up in Cecil Court," she added, in an aside to Stephen.
And then loud and clear to Padine, as though he were at the masthead,
"In the weary middle, Padine, between the spare sheets and the lamb's wool drawers."
Padine repeatedly touched his forehead in submission, and as soon as she had gone, he and Stephen, having looked quickly round the room, moved chairs to the foot of a tall wardrobe. Even with a chair, however, Stephen was unable to reach the top, and he was obliged to stand there, giving Padine pages of the Times, then shirts, then more pages, and advice on just how they were to be laid. And he was in this posture, uttering the words, "Never mind the frill, so the collar does not show," when the slim, light-footed Lucy darted in, crying,
"An express for the doctor! Oh, sir!"
She understood the position in the first second. She gazed with horror and then with extreme disapprobation. They looked wretchedly confused, guilty, lumpish. They found nothing to say, until Stephen muttered,
"We were just laying them there for now."
Lucy pursed her lips and said,
"Here is your letter, sir,"
putting it down on the table. Stephen said,
"You need not mention it to Mrs. Broad, Lucy."
Lucy said,
"I never was a telltale yet, but oh, Padine, and your hands all covered with the dust up there for shame."
Stephen took the letter, and his look of nervous guilt vanished as he recognised Jack Aubrey's hand.
"Padine," he said, "wash your hands, will you now, and leap down to the bar and ask them to let me have a jug of lemon barley water."
He pulled his elbow chair to the window and broke the familiar seal.
"Ashgrove Cottage. My dear Stephen, give me joy. In his very great goodness, my cousin Edward has offered me the seat for the borough of Millport, which he owns. We went and passed a day or so among the burgesses, an affable set of men who are kind enough to say that because of St. Martin's and the Azores affair, they would have voted for me in any case, even if cousin Edward had not advised them to do so.
While we were there, a messenger came posting down from the ministry with proposals for my cousin. But, said he, they could not be attempted to be entertained since he was already committed to me. The messenger looked blank and posted off again. So I went home. After another day at Cousin Edward's place, he particularly wished me to see his roses at their height, and I absolutely could not do less, and I was telling Sophie the news with all that I hoped might follow from it, for perhaps the 20th time, when Heneage Dundas walked in. I knew Eurydice was come back, but I had not had time to go down to Pompey to welcome him home, and when I sent to ask him to dinner, they said he had gone up to town, so we were not astonished to see him. We supposed he was returning to his ship and had turned off the road at Jericho to look in upon us. But we were surprised when, after having spoken very handsomely indeed about the Diane, and having begged me to describe the cutting out in the greatest detail, he grew rather strange, shy, and reserved, and after a while said he was come not only as a friend, but also as an emissary. The ministry, said he, had heard that I was to be member for Millport. His brother rejoiced at the news because this additional influence in my favour would allow him to urge his colleagues even more strongly that I should be reinstated by mere motion, that is to say, without having to sue out any pardon. But in order to do so with full effect, Melville would have to be able to assure them of my attitude in the House. It was not required that I should engage to support the ministry through thick and thin, but Melville hoped he could say that at least I should not violently and systematically oppose it, that I should not be a vehement or enthusiastic member. I looked at Sophie, who knew perfectly well what I meant. She nodded, and I said to Heneage that it was excessively unlikely I should ever address the House on anything but a naval question, for I had seen too many sea officers brought by the lee meddling with politics, that in general I should be happy to vote for almost any measure proposed by Lord Melville, whom I esteemed so highly and whose father I owed such a debt of gratitude to. While as for enthusiasm or ranting, even my worst enemies could not accuse me of either. Heneage agreed and said nothing could possibly make him happier than carrying back such a message, that Melville had told him that in the event of a favourable answer the papers would be put in hand directly, and that although they would take some months to pass through all the proper channels, while the official announcement would not be made until it could coincide with some victory in the peninsula, or even better at sea, he undertook that my name and present command should be placed on a special list, and that I should not suffer in seniority. "Lord Stephen, we are so happy! Sophie goes singing about the House. She says she would give anything for you to share our joy, so here I am scribbling this in the greatest haste, hoping it may catch you before you set out for Leith. But if it don't, then I shall have the delight of telling you when we meet in Sweden. There is only one change in our arrangements I wish to suggest, and that is that since we shall already be in the Baltic, I should run across to Riga for cordage, spars, and especially Poldavi for our voyage. The finest Poldavi I ever saw in my life came from Riga. God bless you, Stephen. Sophie bids me send her dear love. Yours ever, John Aubrey."
"What now?" cried Stephen, quickly sliding the letter under a book.
"If you please, sir,"
said Mrs. Broad, whose mild face was perfectly unconscious of the wardrobe.
"Sir Joseph is below and asks if you are at leisure."
"Certainly I am at leisure. Pray beg him to walk up."
"Heavens, Maturin, how glad I am to find you," said Blaine. "I was so afraid you might have set off already."
"The mail does not leave until 6:30."
"The mail? I had imagined you would take a chaise."
"At 14 pence a mile?" said Stephen, with a knowing, worldly look. "No, sir."
"Well," said Sir Joseph, smiling, "I can save you not only the monstrous expense of the mail, but also the dismal jerking and trundling crammed night and day into an airless box with a parcel of strangers, more or less clean as the case may be, the hurried meals, the incessant don't forget the coachman, sir, and even the cruel bore of running down from Edinburgh to Leith, and then going aboard the packet at even greater cost to both purse and spirit, then being quite fagged out by then."
"How do you propose to do this beautiful thing, my valued friend?"
"By putting you aboard the Netley cutter early tomorrow morning. She is carrying messages and messengers to a number of ships at the Nore, and among them, Maturin, among them, as I learnt by telegraph only an hour or so ago, is the Leopard, bound for Yeffler."
"Not the horrible old Leopard that took us to New Holland, drowning, wrecking, and starving us on the way?" cried Stephen.
"The same. But she is now shorn of most of her guns, and she sails under the colours of the Transport Board. Indeed, her present humble task is to fetch marine stores from Yefle, taking the place of another transport seized by a couple of Americans in the Skagger Rack. I heard of it only this afternoon when the Commissioner's report came in, stating that with diligence the Leopard could be made ready for sea tomorrow. I happened to be in the way, and as soon as I heard she was to sail for Yefle, I said I shall tell Maturin at once. They can drop him off at Stockholm without the loss of a minute, and it will save him all this wearisome toiling and moiling, bad company and worse food, as well as a mint of money. I hurried out, searched for you at Black's, searched for you in the British Museum, searched for you in Somerset House, and ran you to earth here, where I should have begun in the first place. I would have spared me a world of heat and passion, thrusting my way through slow-moving hordes of bumpkins. London is filled with bumpkins at this time of the year. They stare about them like oxen.
"It was benevolent in you to grow so hot," said Joseph, "and I am infinitely obliged to you for your care. Will you take a glass of lemon barley water, or do you prefer a draught of moist and corny ale?"
"The ale, if you please, and it cannot be too moist for me. I must have lost a stone in my striving course. But it was worth it. Dear me, Maturin, how happy I was to find you. It would really have put me out of temper for a month to have lost my message."
He drank half his ale, gasped, and went on. "Besides, it would have prevented me from inviting you to hear a very charming Figaro with me tonight. The young person that sings Cherubino has an androgynous perfection in breeches, and such a voice." He went on to speak of the rest of the cast, particularly a glorious Contessa. Yet Stephen, watching him, perceived that he was cherishing the secret of some other piece of news, and presently it came out.
"But although listening to the music and telling you about your passage in the Leopard was a great point," said Blaine, "sending you off with an easy mind was a greater one by far."
Blaine was an unmarried man with no near family, and though he had a very wide acquaintance, he had almost no close friends. While his profession was one in which the kindlier virtues had little play. But this was one of the rare occasions on which friendship, and indeed the interest of the service, came together, and he gazed affectionately at Stephen for quite a time before saying,
"Jack Aubrey is to be returned for Millport. Ha, ha, ha!"
He stood up, clapped Stephen on the shoulder, and walked about the room.
"For Millport? Ain't you amazed? I was, I can tell you. His father's constituency. Such a degree, such a pitch of magnanimity in the owner of a borough I have never seen nor heard of. Above all, that borough, a remote connection, I believe. Have you met Mr. Norton, Maturin?"
"I just saw him at Jack Aubrey's wedding, a tall, thin gentleman."
"It makes all the difference," said Blaine, carrying straight on. "It comes exactly at the right time. I had, of course, thought of a pocket borough to give just that weight needed to bring the balance right down on his side. They tend to be costly boroughs, but in the circumstances I should have suggested it, if only there had been an uncommitted seat on the market, which there is not. Never for a moment did it occur to me that the only vacancy should be, as it were, poured into his lap."
"That is scarcely a correct expression, Blaine."
"No, to be sure, but how beautifully it suits the occasion. Melville has sent his brother Heneage down, and I am sure he will handle the matter far better than Soames. They are old friends, and apart from anything else, this is to be one of your discreet, mere motion affairs, with no explicit conditions of any sort. Though I dare say Heneage Dundas, speaking as one sailor to another, may persuade him not to be too hard on Melville and his colleagues."
"How I rejoice at what you tell me, Blaine," said Stephen. "I have no doubt that Heneage Dundas is the perfect negotiator. From what I know of Jack Aubrey's mind, he cannot fail to be successful. Yet you might still think it worth pointing out to your political friends that the only absolutely certain way of making sure that a sailor does not address the House at interminable length, either on naval abuses or on some subject of which he is deeply ignorant, is to send him on a very long voyage. There is the South American situation to be looked into, sure, but then there are also the complex rivalries between the Malay sultans, which worry the East India Company, so there is all that poor dear Captain Cook and the less satisfactory Vancouver had to leave undone. And think of the untouched entomology of the Celebes. Let us drink a bottle of champagne."
The champagne and its charming stir of spirits had long since faded by the time the Leopard was creeping past the Swin in the graveyard watch on Friday. Every minute she fired a windward gun into the fog. Her drum beat continually on the forecastle, though the wet took away most of its resonance, and the man in the chains cast his lead without a pause, his hoarse voice chanting,
"By the mark, seven! By the mark, seven! By the deep, six and a half, six!"
Sometimes rising in urgency to,
"By the mark, five and a half, five!"
as the leeward bank came closer. The ship was barely making two knots in the murk, but the soundings changed fast, and all around, in directions and at distances hard to estimate, came answering gunshots, cries, and drums from the merchantmen or warships making their way to or from the London River, while dim lights appeared and then vanished in deeper fog when they were even closer. It was an unpleasant time to be navigating busy shoal water, and the captain, his pilot, and the more responsible men were still on deck, as they had been, with rare intervals, ever since Stephen came aboard in the last hour of clear weather. The Leopard had been hurried to sea, undermanned and ill-prepared. Her decks were all a-who, and his reception did no one any credit, though to be sure he could hardly have chosen a worse moment, with the ship winning her anchor. Yet his heart had sunk long before this, long before the testy, "Go below, sir, go below! Did his goddamn chest out of the way!" From half a mile he had not recognised the ship, and had supposed the cutter's midshipman was making game of him. But then, piecing together curves, masses and proportions, all lodged somewhere in the uncatalogued library of his mind, he had seen that this old transport was indeed the Leopard. She had hogged, which gave her a droopy-eared look of extreme shabbiness, and she had been given a 32-gun frigate's masts to lighten her burden, which had deformed her entire outline, rendering it mean, and her paintwork was a disgrace. That was sad enough, and coming aboard was sad enough, but it was not until he went below to the absurdly familiar wardroom, familiar even in the trick of its door catching on the sill and the tilting scuttle of the quarter-gallery with its worn brass lock, that he realised what kind, affectionate, even loving memories he had preserved, and how he resented the old ship's degradation. Dirt and carelessness everywhere, everywhere a change for the worse. Of course, she could not be judged by her standards as a man of war, when a taut captain and a zealous first lieutenant had 340 men to keep her just so. Yet even by the very much less ambitious notions of the common coasting trade, she was a dirty ship. A dirty ship, and an unhappy one. Long before he went up the side, helped by the cheerful cutter's midshipman, Stephen had had a premonition of disaster, and although the happiness or unhappiness of the ship was wholly irrelevant to his sense of personal catastrophe, the feeling was strengthened by his first sight of the Leopard's captain and pilot wrangling, while three of the officers steadily lashed the men heaving at the capstan bars, swearing as loud as ever they could bawl. Supper was no very cheerful ceremony either. The drizzling fog, the slight and shifting wind, the dangerous currents and shoals, and the risk of collision would have made it an anxious meal even in the old Leopard. Now it was barbarous as well. The wardroom was divided into two hostile groups, the master's friends and the purser's, and as far as Stephen could see they were equally determined to show their lack of respect for the captain, a tall, thin, elderly, weak, ill-tempered, clerk-like man who looked in from time to time. There were also some other passengers for Sweden, marine store merchants, and each of these three groups kept up its own whispered conversation. The passengers, and Stephen belonged more among them than elsewhere, since the Leopard's surgeon was dead drunk in his cabin, were of no interest whatsoever to the sailors. They were mere landsmen, often a nuisance, often sick, always in the way, come today and gone tomorrow, but they did serve as a means of communication between the hostile camps. Words ostensibly addressed to a hemp buyer from Austin Friars bounced off him to reach the far end of the table, and in this way Stephen learnt that still another collier had hailed to say that Americans had been sighted off the Overfalls heading south. So the old man was going inside the Oa and the Haddock Bank. Shortly after this, all hands were called to fend off a Dutch bus that had fallen aboard the Leopard's quarter, in spite of all the yelling and gunfire. Stephen followed the merchants onto the wet, dark, slippery deck, found that he could neither see anything nor do anything, and so retired. The cries of, "Butter boxes! Bugger off!" growing fainter as he went down to his cabin and closed the door. Since then he had lain on his back, with his hands behind his head, in what had been Babington's cot during the leopard's voyage to the Spice Islands by way of the Antarctic, had lain swinging with the easy motion of the ship. In the course of what now amounted to many years, he had imperceptibly become so much of a seaman that he found this posture and this living heave the most comfortable attitude and motion known to man, the best for either sleep or reflection, in spite of the sound of the ship's working, the shouts and footsteps overhead, and on this occasion the thump of the signal gun. For the first part of the night, while he was waiting for his draught to have its effect, he deliberately composed his mind to help sleep come. There was a vast expanse in which his thoughts could take their pleasure. Jack Aubrey's affairs could hardly be more prosperous, and short of a very hideous mischance, Stephen unhooked his hand to cross himself, it was scarcely possible that he should not be fully, publicly reinstated within the next few months. He would most probably be given a command after the South American voyage, and perhaps it would be another independent commission. His genius lay that way. Conceivably they might explore the high northern latitudes together. Extremely interesting, no doubt, though they could scarcely hope for the fantastic wealth of the South again. Stephen's mind returned to Desolation Island, where this very ship had taken him. Physically, these very same timbers, battered and uncared for though they were now. Desolation, with its sea elephants and countless penguins, petrels of every kind, and the glorious albatrosses that would let him pick them up, warm, and if not companionable, then at least in no way hostile. Whale birds, blue-eyed shags, the crab seals, the leopard seals, the otaries. His mind, perhaps a little too conscientious in its pursuit of happiness, turned back to his evening with Blaine. He dwelt for a while on their excellent meal, their bottle of Latour, so smooth and round and long, and reviewed Sir Joseph's confidential words as they finished their wine. Retirement to the country, to gardening and etymology did not answer. Attempted once, never again. Night thoughts in an unoccupied mind at his age, with his experience and with his trade behind him, were too disagreeable. Pervading sense of guilt, though each separate case could be satisfactorily answered. Present activity and the busy persecution of the enemy was the only answer. And from this he moved to the opera, where they had heard a truly brilliant performance of Le Nozze di Figaro, brilliant from the first notes of the overture to what Stephen always looked upon as the true end before the hurly-burly of jovial peasants, the part where from a dead silence the dumbfounded Conte sings Contessa perdono, 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 with such an infinite subtlety of intonation. He repeated it inwardly several times, together with the Contessa's exquisite reply, and the crowd's words to the effect that now they would all live happily ever after. A tutti contenti saremo così, but never quite to his satisfaction. At some point he must have dozed off, for as he woke he was conscious that the watch had changed and that the ship's speed had increased by perhaps a knot. The drum had stopped beating on the forecastle, but the gun still uttered its gruff bark every minute or so. And his inner voice was still singing, A tutti contenti saremmo così. It had the cadences more nearly in their true line, but oh, how much less conviction there was in those words at present. They were now purely mechanical, a mindless repetition, because in his sleep that earlier premonition of extreme unhappiness had risen up, and now it occupied him entirely. It now appeared evident to him that his visit to Sweden must be seen as an odious importunity. It was true that he was carrying back her blue diamond, which she valued extremely, but it could have been sent by a messenger. It could have been sent through the legation. And this bringing it in person might be looked upon as a singularly ungenerous demand for gratitude, necessarily self-defeating as far as the essence was concerned. Blaine was probably right in saying that Diana was not or was no longer attached to Jagiello. Stephen hoped so, because he liked the beautiful young man, and he did not look forward to the conventional bloody meeting with any pleasure. Yet that did not mean that she was not attached to some other man, perhaps much poorer, more discreet, less in the public eye. Diana was a passionate creature, and when she was attached, she was usually attached passionately. Stephen knew very well that in their relations the very strong feeling was all on his side. She had a certain liking friendship and affection for him, but certainly no passion of any kind. Passionate resentment of his supposed infidelity, perhaps, but no other. There were large and important areas of Diana's mind that were as strange to him as his was to her, but he was quite sure of one thing. Her love of high, expensive living was far more theoretical than real. Certainly she hated being pinched and confined, but she hated being commanded even more. She might love careless extravagance, but she would do little or nothing to come by the means of it. Certainly nothing against her inclination. She valued nothing so much as her independence. Nothing was more valuable to her than her independence. What had he to offer in exchange for even a very little part of it, for the appearance of even a very little part of it? Money, of course. But of course in this context money was neither here nor there. If kissing did not go by favour, it was not kissing at all. What else had he to offer? He might have 10,000 a year and a deer park, at least a potential deer park, but by no stretch of the imagination could he be called a handsome husband, nor even a tolerable husband. He had little conversation and no charm. He had offended her very publicly and very deeply, or so she and her friends believed, which came to the same thing. The more he reflected on it, lying there in the heave of the sea as the leopard carried him towards Sweden, the more it seemed to him that his premonition was well-founded, that his journey could not be anything but an exquisitely painful failure. At the same time he found the unreasoning part of his mind so longing for its success that he became physically distressed, seized with a kind of rigour that made him gasp. Presently he sat up, clasping his hands and rocking to and fro, and in time, against all good sense, all resolution and fortitude, he opened his chest, groped for the bottle, and repeated his night draught. He woke not so much from a laudanum sleep, for by now his tincture would have had little effect on a well-grown child, as from an unusual degree of mental exhaustion. Yet in spite of that he was still so stupid that he might have been stuffed with poppy, mandrake, and nepenthe, and it took him some moments to understand the steward's cry.
"Come on, sir! We'm sunk!"
The man repeated his words, shaking the cot's hangings as he did so, and Stephen recognised the steady, grinding thump below. The ship was aground, beating not on rock but on sand.
"Sunk?"
he said, sitting up.
"Well, no, sir," said the steward. "That was just my jovial way of putting it, to rouse you like. But that wicked little old bugger has run us onto the tail of the Grab, and Mr. Roke is going ashore for help. Captain thinks the passengers should run in with him, in case the ship goes to pieces."
"Thank you, steward," said Stephen, getting up, tying his neckcloth, which was all he had taken off, and locking his chest.
"Pray give a seaman this," handing him a crown piece, "to see my dunnage into the boat, and if you could bring me a cup of coffee on deck, you would oblige me."
On the deck itself he found a thin, grey daylight, drizzle but no wind, and the ship beating less as she settled with a falling tide. The boatswain had the pilot wedged against the rail, and between insults the captain hit him with a rope's end. The other members of the crew were methodically getting a boat over the side, taking little notice of the pilot's cries. No land was in sight, nothing but yellowish-grey drizzle over yellowish-grey sea, but the people seemed confident of their whereabouts, and there was no feeling of particular emergency. Yet once over the side and manned, the boat proved leaky, and they had not shoved off 5 minutes before water was washing about their feet.
"Jog the low," cried Mr. Roke, addressing Stephen, and then louder, "Jog the low, I say."
A friendly young mate, unseen before this moment, leant over Stephen and briskly worked the pump handle up and down. They would be in Manton before the turn of the tide, he said, and if Stephen wished to put up at a comfortable inn, he could recommend the Feathers, kept by his auntie. It would not be a long stay, in all likelihood. They had just beat off the rudder and lost some of the false keel, but Joe Harris of Manton would tow them in and put them to rights as soon as she floated. The passengers were only put ashore because of the insurance. Stephen need not be afraid.
"Jog the loo!" cried Mr. Roke.
"There's Manton right ahead,"
observed the young man, when Stephen had more or less cleared the boat. It was a promising East Anglian landscape, a flat, flat mingling of the elements with decayed sea-walls, saltings, reed-beds in the half-light, and the smell of marsh gas and seaweed mixed.
"Do you know the Reverend Mr. Heath of Manton?"
asked Stephen.
"Parson Heath?
"'Why, everyone knows Parson Heath. "'We always carry him anything rare, like a sea baby or a king of the herrings.'
"'Mr. Roke started up, balancing in the boat.
"'Now, sir,' he said very loud, "'if you will not jog that bloody loo, "'change places with me, and I will jog it myself.'
"'In the front room, on the first floor of the William's Head at Chelmerston, "'Sophie read out,
"'Bread in bags, £21,226, "'the same in butts, £13,440, "'flour for bread in barrels, £9,000, "'beer in puncheons, 1,200 gallons, "'spirits, 1,600 gallons, "'beef, 4,000 pieces, "'flour in lieu of beef in half barrels, £1,400, "'suet, £800, "'raisins, £2,500, "'peas in butts, 187 bushels, "'oatmeal, 10 bushels, "'wheat, 120 bushels, "'oil, 120 gallons, "'sugar, £1,500, "'vinegar, 500 gallons, "'sauerkraut, £7,860, "'malt in hogsheads, 40 bushels, "'salt, 20 bushels, "'pork, 6,000 pieces, "'mustard seed, £160, "'inspissated lime juice, 10 kegs, "'lemon rob, 15 kegs, "'The prices are on the list by the inkwell. "'I've worked out all the sums except the last two, "'which Dr. Maturin has already paid. "'Perhaps we could compare our answers.'
"'While Mr. Standish, the surprise's new and inexperienced purser, "'was multiplying and dividing, "'Sophie looked out of the window at the sunlit bay. "'The surprise was lying against Bolter's Wharf, "'taking in the vast quantities of stores "'recorded on the papers lying there on the table.' The frigate was not looking her best, with her hatchways agape and derricks peering into her depths, while it would have been folly to lay on her last coat of paint before the lading was complete. But a seaman's eye would have observed the new suit of Manila rigging, which any king's ship might have envied, to say nothing of the blaze of gold leaf on her figurehead and the scrolls behind it. In the course of her long career she had been called L'Unité, the Retaliation, and the Retribution, and the rather cross-looking image in front had answered, more or less, for any of these names. But now some natural genius had arched her eyebrows and pursed her mouth, so that she really was the personification of surprise. Pleased surprise, with a great wealth of golden locks and an undeniable bosom. As Sophie gazed, she saw her children rush by below, saw, and above all, heard them. They could never at any time have been called genteel children, having been brought up mainly by strong-voiced, plain-speaking, overfond seamen. But now that they had been let loose for some time among a whole community of adoring privateersmen, stuffed with sweetmeats and nips of sugared gin, loaded with knives, poll parrots, and shrunken heads from foreign parts, they were in a fair way to being ruined. At present, Bondon and Killick were nominally in charge of them, but both were encumbered by Jack Aubrey's evening finery. The Aubreys were to dine with Admiral Russell, and they had been left far behind. In answer to their increasingly threatening cries, the two girls stopped, poised on the low wall overlooking the hard. With admirable timing, their little brother gave them each a shove, so that they fell a good 4 feet onto the shore. He pelted off for the ship as fast as his short legs could carry him, and they were picked out of the low-tide shingle by three women of the town, dusted, comforted, and mended in the kindest way. Charlotte's pinafore was torn. They were also told very firmly that they must not call out after their brother with such words as sod, swab, and whoreson beast, because their mamma would not like it. Their mamma did not like it, and she would have liked it even less if she had not known that they could switch from one kind of language to another without the slightest difficulty. Yet even so she turned to Mrs. Martin, who was darning her husband's stockings, and said,
"My dear Mrs. Martin, I shall be heartbroken when the ship sails, but if those children stay here much longer, I am afraid they will grow into perfect little savages." "Two more days will do them no harm," said Mrs. Martin comfortably. "And it is only 2 more days, I believe." "I am afraid it is," said Sophie. "The sauerkraut is promised for tomorrow, Mr. Standish."
"Yes, ma'am, and I am confident it will come," said the purser, adding still.
She sighed. Of course, she was sorry, very deeply sorry to be losing her husband, and the prospect, though foreseen, though inevitable, and though prayed for with all her heart and soul at one time, made her desperately low in her spirits. Yet some exceedingly small part of this lowness was also connected with her leaving Chelmerston. She had lived a very quiet, retired life, and although she had been twice to Bath, twice to London and several times to Brighton, Shelmerston was unlike anything she had seen or imagined. Indeed, it was the nearest thing to a Caribbean pirate's base that any English country gentlewoman was likely to see, particularly as the sun had shone brilliantly from the day of her arrival. Yet it was a base inhabited by the civilest of pirates, where she could walk anywhere, smiled upon and saluted, wandering and exploring the narrow sanded streets without the least apprehension, she being the wife of the most deeply admired, most deeply respected man in the port, the commander of that fabulous gold mine, the Surprise. The whores and demi-whores had startled her at first, for although she had noticed the odd trollop in Portsmouth, she had never seen anything like this number. A considerable part of the population calmly accepted. There were some wicked old screws among them, but upon the whole they were young, pretty, brightly dressed and cheerful. They sang and laughed and had a great deal of fun, especially in the evening when they danced. They fascinated Sophie, and as she had several times thanked them openly and sincerely for their kindness to her children, they bore her no ill will for her virtue. Indeed, the whole town fascinated her. There was always something going on, and if she had not engaged to help young Mr. Standish with his accounts, she would rarely have left the broad bow window that commanded the entire seafront, the wharves, the shipping, and the bay itself, a royal box in a never-ending theatre. The chief event of this afternoon was the appearance of the Williams carriage, a vehicle originally intended for the Spanish Captain General of Guatemala, and very highly decorated to impress the natives of those parts. However, it had been taken by a Shelmerston privateer during the Seven Years' War, and resigned to the William in settlement of a debt some 50 years ago. The builders had had a team of 6 or 8 mules in mind, but now, on the rare occasions the machine came out, it was drawn by 4 wandering farm horses from old Shelmerston, and at this moment, having cleared the arch from the stable yard, they trotted soberly off towards Bolter's Wharf, accompanied by the children of the town, running on either side and cheering, and Sophie hurried upstairs to put on her sprigged muslin. For some time it had been an open secret in the Navy that Jack Aubrey was to be restored to the post-captain's list. He no longer declined invitations. Indeed, he entertained large parties of his old friends, straining the Williams resources to the utmost, and he thoroughly looked forward to dining with Admiral Russell.
"The only thing I regret," he said, as the carriage bowled along the turnpike road behind Alicombe, "is that Stephen is not here. The Admiral has invited the new physician of the fleet, and they would have got along together famously."
"Poor dear Stephen," said Sophie, shaking her head. "I suppose he will be in Sweden by now."
"I suppose he will, if he has made a good passage," said Jack.
They looked at one another gravely and said no more until the carriage turned in at the Admiral's gates. Stephen had not made a good passage. In fact, at this point, he had not advanced much above 30 miles towards Stockholm, and even by the time the Surprise put to sea 2 days later, the Leopard, with her new rudder and false keel at last, had only just lost sight of Manton Church. After the first few days' wait, there was little point in Stephen's travelling north by land, because he would never have caught the packet. He therefore stayed where he was, settling at the Feathers and spending much of the day with his friend Parson Heath. As Stephen admitted to himself, he was not unwilling to have his journey delayed by shipwreck, act of God, or anything truly out of his control. And then on quite another plane he was happy to become familiar with Ruffs and Reeves. He had seen them often enough passing through the Mediterranean lagoons on migration, rather dull birds. But now, leading him to a wild fowler's hide day after day, Heath showed him scores and even hundreds of ruffs in the full glory of their mating plumage, dancing, quivering and sparring with one another, showing the extraordinary variety of their frills in ritual battle, all apparently in a state of unquenchable sexual excitement.
"A powerful instinct, Maturin, I believe," said Mr. Heath.
"Powerful indeed, sir, powerful indeed."
The Reeves instinct, though certainly less spectacular, was perhaps stronger still. In spite of total neglect from their mates, the eagerness of predators whose living depended on their efficiency, and some exceptionally bitter weather, Stephen and Heath saw 3 of the brave birds bring off their entire clutch, while a 4th began hatching just as a choir boy messenger came to say that the Leopard was moving out of the yard. The leopards themselves improved slightly on acquaintance. This was partly because as soon as she was towed out of Manton Harbour, a fine-to-gallant breeze filled her sails and carried her along at 6 and even 7 knots, a splendid pace for her in her present state, and one that put even the sullen Mr. Roke in a good humour. It was also because a disabled seaman, once a foremast hand in the Boadicea, and now employed in the Manton Yard, recognised Dr. Maturin, while at the same time the broad sheet of sailcloth nailed to his sea-chest, a temporary direction with the words S. Maturin, passenger to Stockholm, was torn off as the chest came aboard again, revealing the names of the ships he had served in, painted on the front according to the custom of the service, and crossed through with a fine red line at the end of each commission. Stephen had noticed that seafaring men, though upon the whole somewhat credulous and ignorant of the world, were often knowing, suspicious, and wary at the wrong time. But this independent double testimony was irresistible. And at dinner on the first day out, Mr. Roke, after a general silence, said,
"So it seems you was a leopard, sir."
"Just so," said Stephen.
"Why did you never tell us when you came aboard?"
"You never asked. He did not like to show away," said the purser.
They pondered on this, and then the surgeon said,
"You must be the Dr. Maturin of the Diseases of Seamen."
Stephen bowed. The purser sighed and shook his head and observed that that was the board all over. They just gave you a chitty, saying, "Receive so-and-so aboard to be borne for victuals only as far as Stockholm, without a word of his quality. He might be Agamemnon or Nebuchadnezzar, and you would be none the wiser."
"We thought you was just an ordinary commercial going to the Baltic on business, like these gents,"
pointing at the merchants, who looked down at the spotted tablecloth.
"She was still a man of war when you was in her, I dare say," said Roke.
"It was her last voyage as a 50-gun ship, the voyage in which she sank the Waxamheit, a Dutch 74, in the high southern latitudes. It was not a well-known action, because in those waters there could be no remains, no prisoners, and I believe it was never gazetted."
"Oh, tell us about it, Doctor, if you please,"
cried Roke, his face shining with sudden reflected glory, and the other sailors drew their chairs nearer.
"A 50-gun ship to sink a 74!"
"You must understand that I was below, and that although I heard the gunfire, I saw nothing of it. All I can tell you is what I was told by those that took part."
They did not mind at all. They listened greedily, pressing him for exact details, requiring him to repeat various episodes so that they should get it just so, for the Leopard, though now at some removes from her state of grace, was still their ship. That was the great point. They were polite about Jack Aubrey's recent feats, indignant at his ill usage, too, but all that was on a different plane and quite remote. It was the Leopard, the tangible Leopard, that really mattered. In the next few days he told the tale, or particular actions in it, again and again, sometimes in the captain's cabin, where he was invited to dine, and where he pointed out the exact places where the stern chasers had been made fast, and where traces could still be seen, sometimes on the quarter-deck, where his hearers put him right if he made the slightest change of epithet or order. And all this while the breeze held true, running them north-northeast as fast as they could wish. Faster than ever Stephen wished. He saw his first northern birds, Ida in the Skagger Rack, with a sinking heart. A kindly western shift wafted them down the Kattegat and right through the belt. Never a pause until a broken for topmast checked them a little north of Åland. From then on their progress was slow, and they lost all hope of an excellent run, which caused a great deal of cursing and irritation. Yet their progress could not be too slow for him, and these hours of dawdling were a relief from his continually mounting tension. But for all that, on Thursday morning, when the Surprise heaved in sight, he went aboard her directly. He had come on deck unusually early, having had a poor night and having been unable to bear another comic sneeze in the wardroom. His colleague, the present surgeon of the Leopard, was not a bad young man, but he had come by the notion that it was droll to exaggerate the sound of a sneeze. By now it had grown perfectly habitual, and every time he made this din, which was quite often, he would gaze round the table to share the fun. Stephen was early on deck, therefore, and he found the captain and most of his officers peering anxiously at a vessel to windward, hull up on the starboard quarter.
"She has no pennant," said the captain. "She cannot be a man of war."
"No, she's a privateer for sure, an American privateer," said the master.
If only you'd got the topmast up last night, we might have run into Vestavik. There's no hope now. Look at her feather.
A very fine feather it was. With t'gallants and weather stunsails abroad, she was making better than 10 knots, and her bows threw the white water wide on either side. During their mutual reproaches, for the master naturally returned the captain's blame, the pleasant young mate, whose name was Francis, borrowed Roke's telescope. He stared long and hard, and then with a worried face he passed the glass to Stephen.
"Comfort yourself, Mr. Francis," said Stephen, when he had made triply sure. "That is the surprise, commanded by Mr. Aubrey. He was to meet me in Stockholm. Captain Woolwich, may I beg you to lie to and hang out a flag to show that we should like to communicate with her? She will take me into Stockholm, and that will be a great saving of time."
He had acquired great authority as the oldest leopard of them all. He now spoke with staggering assurance, and the alternative was so worthless that Woolwich said he was always ready to oblige a king's officer, and the leopard laid her main topsail to the mast. No one could have looked at the new member for Millport's face without his heart lifting. It was not that Jack Aubrey's was exultant or filled with obvious pleasure. Indeed, for some time after they had lain close to the leopard, it was clouded. But it possessed a shining inner life, a harmony of its own, and the strange, almost paralytic deadness that had hung over it in repose these last months was now quite gone. His had been a naturally cheerful countenance, until joy was driven out of it. A fine, ruddy face whose lines and creases had been formed by laughter and smiling. Now it was essentially the same again, ruddier, if anything, and lit by eyes that seemed an even brighter blue. Stephen felt his sadness and near desperation recede, almost vanished, as they talked and talked about Cousin Edward Norton's extraordinarily handsome conduct, and about the House of Commons, where they agreed that Jack's wisest course would be silence, except in the case of overwhelming conviction on a naval point, and a general but by no means unconditional support of the ministry, or at least of Lord Melville. Then, having heard a fairly detailed account of the leopard's grounding, Jack, together with Pullings and Martin, showed Stephen the new Manila rigging and the slightly greater rake they had given the foremast.
"I believe she gains an extra fathom of line," said Jack.
"Sure, she's going as fast as a horse at a good round trot," said Stephen, looking over the side at the swift, smooth run of the sea, dipping to show the ship's copper amidships.
And as he spoke, he realized that each hour was bringing him some 10 miles nearer Stockholm, and that tomorrow would probably see him ashore.
"I should not trust this wind, though," said Pullings. "It has been veering all this watch, and I doubt the stunsails stand until 8 bells.
This view of the present racing along to become the future grew in Stephen's mind as they ate their dinner, and by the time they had said everything that could be said about Parliament, Ashgrove, Woolcombe, the children, Philip Aubrey, and the Surprise's new iron water tanks, his mind tended to stray again. In spite of the very profound satisfaction of seeing the old Jack Aubrey on the other side of the table, his anxiety was welling up again. Jack knew why Stephen had come into the Baltic, of course, and towards the end of the meal he saw that his friend was looking both wretchedly ill and 10 years older. But this was ground he could not possibly venture upon unasked, and after a long, awkward silence, most unusual with them, it occurred to him that he must not return to his own affairs, that he had already been far too self-centred and unfeeling. He therefore called for another pot of coffee, and spoke about Standish and music.
"Since we met," he said, "I'm glad to say the ship has acquired a purser. He is not at all experienced, has never been to sea, and Sophie helps him with his sums, but he is a gentlemanlike fellow, a friend of Martin's, and he plays an amazingly fine fiddle."
Standish was of a naval family, though not an eminent one. His father had died a lieutenant, and he had always wanted to go to sea. But his friends were very much against it, and in deference to their wishes he had studied for the church, in which a cousin could provide for him. His studies, however, were more in the boating and classical line than the theological, and it never occurred to him to read the 39 articles with close attention before he was required to subscribe to them. He then found with great concern that he could not conscientiously do so, and that without doing so he could not become a parson. In these circumstances he was at liberty to go to sea, the only thing he really wanted to do. But of course he was now far too old to make his first appearance on the quarter-deck of any man of war. The only way into the Navy was as a purser, and in spite of his inexperience, most pursers started quite young as captain's clerks, an old shipmate of his father's would have used his influence with the Navy Board to have him appointed. But a purser of even a sixth rate had to put up a verifiable bond for £400, and Standish, having disobliged his family, did not possess 400 pence.
"I thought we might waive the bond in view of the fiddle," said Jack. "I do assure you he has a wonderfully true ear and the most delicate touch, neither sweet nor yet dry, if you understand me. And since Martin can scrape away pretty well on his viola, it occurred to me that we might try a quartet. What do you say to our having a bowl of punch and asking him to share it? We will ask Tom and Martin, too."
"I should be very happy to meet the gentleman," said Stephen, "but it is long, long since I touched my cello, and I must have a word with it first."
He went into his cabin, and after the squeaks and grunts of tuning, he played a few bars very softly and called to Jack,
"Do you recognize that?"
"Of course," said Jack. "It comes at the end of Figaro, the loveliest thing."
"I could not sing it quite right," said Stephen, "but it comes out better with a bow."
Then he closed the door, and some moments later the after part of the ship, usually quiet with a following wind and a moderate sea, was filled with a great, deep, roaring dies irae that went on and on, quite startling the quarterdeck. Later, much later, after the punch, the introductions and a good deal of talk, the cabin sang again, but this time with none of the same terrible conviction, more quietly, more gently altogether, as the four of them made their tentative way through Mozart in D major. Stephen went to bed very late that night, his eyes red and watering with the effort of following a little-known score by lamplight, but his mind was wonderfully refreshed, so much so that once he reached the blessed point of sleep, he plunged down and down, reaching a world of extraordinarily vivid dream, and never rising up until Jack said,
"Forgive me for waking you, Stephen, but the wind has veered 9 points, and I cannot get into Stockholm. There is a pilot galley alongside that will take you, or you could run across to Riga with me and put in on our return. Which had you rather?"
"The galley, if you please."
"Very well," said Jack. "I will tell Padine to bring the hot water."
While he was waiting for it to come, Stephen stropped his razor. But when all was ready, he found his hand shake too much to attempt shaving.
"I am in a sad, foolish way, so I am," he said.
And to pull himself together, he reached for his draught. He dropped it before he had poured a single drop into his glass. The cabin was filled with a smell more of brandy than of laudanum, and for a moment he stared at the broken pieces, perceiving the contradiction but lacking the time and mental energy to resolve it. By going below and rousing out a great carboy and a small bottle, he could replace what he had lost.
"The hell with it," he said. "I shall get some more in Stockholm, and I shall be shaved at a barber's, too."
"There you are, Stephen," said Jack, looking at him anxiously. "You will have a long pull of it, I'm afraid. Are you not taking Padine?"
Stephen shook his head.
"I just wanted to say, before you come on deck, I just wanted to ask you to give Cousin Diana our love."
"Thank you, Jack," said Stephen. "I shall not forget."
They walked up the ladder.
"This wind never lasts," said Jack,
handing him over the side where Bondon and Place eased him down into the boat.
"We shall be back from Riga in no time at all."